Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for the Technology Report and This is America, coming up after As It Is.
Hello, and welcome to As It Is from VOA Learning English. I'm Christopher Cruz in Washington. Today on the program, we will tell you about and listen to different kinds of American music. We will report on the growing popularity of mariachi music, especially in states along the border with Mexico.
It's a combination of everything. I believe it's the melting pot of the world then, music-wise.
Then, we will tell you how some Americans used music to support and then fight an amendment to the United States Constitution.
There are people who stop drinking alcohol. About one in five Americans take a temperance pledge, that is, an anti-drinking pledge.
More listeners to mariachi music, and how music played a part in an American constitutional debate. Those are our subjects today on As It Is. Mariachi music has been popular among Mexican Americans in the United States for more than a century. It is especially popular in Texas and other states along the border with Mexico. There are now mariachi groups in all parts of the U.S. and in some European and Asian nations. Mariachi music has long been popular with the large Mexican-American population in San Antonio, Texas. Among the young performers at a recent event was 12-year-old Anani Reims. She is not of Mexican ancestry. She is an African-American. She says she fell in love with the songs she heard in Mexican restaurants and on local radio stations.
I like Las Margaritas, which is about daisies, and I like El Pastor, which is about a shepherd.
Concert producer Cynthia Munoz says Anani Reims shows the appeal of mariachi music.
She feels this very strong connection and love for the music, and it sends a very powerful message to our entire community that this music is truly international.
Singer William Carlton Wayne Galvez is an example of the ethnic mix of mariachi music. He describes himself as one-third Mexican, one-third Anglo, and one-third African-American. He says the music represents it all.
It's a combination of everything. I believe it's the melting pot of the world then, music-wise.
Singers are at the center of mariachi concerts. Guitars, violins, and horns are among the instruments that create the mariachi sound. Texas public schools and state colleges have programs that provide training and a chance to perform in public. The U.S. Congress approved the 21st Amendment to the Constitution more than 80 years ago, on December 5, 1933. The amendment canceled an earlier ban on the production and sale of alcohol in the country. It also marked the end of a political struggle that lasted more than 100 years. The struggle had been argued, in part, through music. Many issues captured the attention of Americans in the years between the War for Independence in the late 1700s and the Civil War in the 1860s. They included the separation of state and religion, and U.S. relations with France and England. While those and other issues came and went, the battle over one subject never stopped. That subject was alcohol.
For there's rum and gin and beer and wine and brandy of logwood hue and hock and port and flip combined to make a man look blue. He says be merry,
for here's good sherry
and Tom and Jerry,
champagne and Perry
and spirits of every hue.
The war against alcohol in the U.S. started in the early 1800s. Before then, Americans had been heavy drinkers. Scott Gack is a professor at Trinity College in Hartford, Connecticut. He wrote a book about reform in the 19th century. He says that in the 1820s and 1830s, American religious leaders began saying that God wanted people to take better care of themselves.
So they start eating differently. There are people who actually become some of the first vegetarians in the United States. There are people who stop drinking alcohol. About one in five Americans take a temperance pledge, that is an anti-drinking pledge. The breadwinner in the family was going out, spending what little money he had, and thus creating poverty for his family. So his wife had to work, his kids had to go out and beg on the street. So drunkenness was eating at the core of American families.
Christian leaders were largely responsible for what became known as the temperance movement. As a result, many of the movement's songs were based on popular Christian hymns. People sang these songs at meetings of groups like the Women's Christian Temperance Union. Its members were known to go out and attack public drinking places with axes.
Oh God, forgive my husband dear, the dying woman said. Though he has been unkind to me, and children cry for bread, and children cry for bread, and children cry for bread. Though he has been unkind to me, and children cry for bread.
By 1900, more than half of the American states had gone dry. In other words, they restricted or even banned the sale of alcohol. Many other people opposed the restrictions. They also expressed themselves in song.
King Ramesses went to pieces 7,000 years ago and passed a law that Egypt must go dry. He took the liquors from the slickers all the way to Jericho, but kept his little toddy on the sly. The desert of Sahara flowed with honey, so they say.
Soon after World War I, temperance supporters had enough votes in Congress to approve a nationwide ban on alcohol. The 18th Amendment to the Constitution banned the manufacture, sale, or transportation of intoxicating liquors. But the Constitution still protected people's right to argue that the prohibition of alcohol was a bad idea, and they did. The ban on alcohol lasted 13 years. By 1933, the anti-alcohol forces admitted defeat. Congress canceled the 18th Amendment, and alcohol flowed freely again in the United States. And that, too, was cause for song.
Prohibition is a failure, most anyone can see. For whiskey sold in every town in the good old USA.
And that's our program for today. I'm Christopher Cruz. Thank you for joining me today on As It Is, on The Voice of America.
From VOA Learning English, this is the Technology Report. East Africa is a growing technology center. The area creates award-winning applications for wireless or mobile devices at a fast rate. The newly established companies there are full of imagination. What they lack are females. One group in Uganda is working to guarantee that women are not left behind in the technology industry. Christine Ampere is a 23-year-old computer program engineer in Uganda. She says girls in Uganda are pressured from an early age to study what many consider to be easy subjects. She says that parents and teachers often think math and science are too difficult for girls.
I wouldn't say they think girls are stupid. They just think that the hard stuff is for boys because they're stronger. They generally assume because she's weaker physically, maybe mentally, she will not cope with the hard stuff.
But Ms. Ampere knows better. 2 years ago, she co-founded Girl Geek Kampala. The group teaches women the skills they need to make profitable applications and websites. They also bring in female technology leaders to speak to the students and serve as models of success in business. Ms. Ampere says one thing Ugandan women lack is the belief that they are able to do things.
In our class, most of the girls just kept quiet and took the back seat when it came to doing coursework and all these other things. And I thought maybe if we had an environment where it's no judgment, it's safe for everyone to say, I want to start from the beginning, it would be really cool.
But Ms. Ampere also says Ugandan women need more than just trust in themselves.
I feel the skills are part of that whole process of building confidence. If I can write my whole app by myself, then I'll be more confident to say I'm a girl in tech.
Girl Geek courses are free. They are held in facilities donated by a technology company. Christine Ampere estimates that they have trained around 150 women so far. Similar programs have been created in Kenya and South Africa. Ms. Ampere says in years past, she would know every one of the women at technology events she attended across Africa. Now, the computer programmer says, she sees more and more new faces.
That kind of excites me, and I'm like, wow, we are growing. The gender imbalance is still high, but you can see the difference. The change is happening.
Joldine Morimbe joined Girl Geek as a beginner 2 years ago. She was not sure that she had the ability to write code. Now, she helps lead the group and teaches classes herself. Ms. Morimbe says Africans are eager for technology.
Everyone here is so hungry to get these things and understand them. They just need to be given the opportunity, especially the girls. They can be as good as anyone out there, given the opportunity.
Ms. Ampere believes that for Ugandan women to truly succeed in technologies, they need to create openings for themselves. She says no one else is going to do that. I'm Jonathan Evans.
From VOA Learning English, welcome to This is America. I'm Steve Ember. Today, Bob Doty and Faith Lapidus tell the story of a very special museum in New York City. A museum that celebrates the people from different nations who came to the United States to live many years ago. Come along with us.
The Lower East Side Tenement Museum is one of the smaller museums in New York. It lets visitors experience how early immigrants to the United States lived. The museum is a building at 97 Orchard Street. It was built in 1863 by a German immigrant named Lucas Glockner. He worked as a tailor, making clothes, before investing his money to develop a property. His tenement building was one of many built in New York as a way to profit from the increasing demand for housing for immigrants.
The word tenement comes from a Latin word meaning to hold. A tenement building holds many rooms where different families lived. The word is not used much anymore in the United States. When people use the word today, they mean an old, crowded building where poor families live in terrible, unhealthy conditions. But in the 1800s, the word tenement simply meant a building in which many families lived. Later, many immigrant families improved their living conditions by moving from the Lower East Side to other areas of New York. Some lived in the same kinds of buildings, but the living areas were cleaner and larger. They did not want to call them tenements, so they called them apartment buildings instead.
History experts say more than half the people in New York lived in tenements in 1863. The building at 97 Orchard Street shows the kind of spaces where families lived. The front room was the largest. It was the only one with a window. Behind it were a kitchen for cooking and a small bedroom for sleeping. The apartment had no running water and no bathroom, toilet, or shower. There were six places where people left their body wastes in the backyard, next to the only place to get drinking water. Such unhealthy conditions led to the spread of disease.
Over the years, New York City officials passed laws to improve conditions in the tenements. The owners of 97 Orchard Street placed gas lighting in the building in the 1890s. They added water and indoor toilets in 1905 and electric power in 1924. Then they refused to make any more improvements. They closed the building in 1935. In 1998, the federal government declared the building a protected National Historic Place.
Museum officials researched the history of the building and its 20 apartments. They found more than 2,000 objects that belonged to people who lived there. These include kitchen devices, medicine bottles, letters, newspapers, money, and pieces of cloth. They also learned the histories of many of the 7,000 people from more than 20 countries who lived there. And they spoke with and recorded memories of people who lived at 97 Orchard Street as children. Museum officials used this information to recreate some of the apartments, as they would have looked during different time periods in the building's history. These apartments are what people see when they visit the Lower East Side Tenement Museum. Let us join one of the guided visits. First, we climb several flights of worn stairs. It is a very hot day, and we feel the heat in the dark, narrow hallway.
Now we enter the apartment of the Gumperts family. They were Jews from Germany who lived here in the 1870s. On October 7th, 1874, Julius Gumperts dressed for work, left the building, and never returned. He left his wife Natalie and their four children, ages 8 months to 7 years. Mrs. Gumperts was forced to support her children by making clothing in the apartment. She earned about $8 a week. This was enough to pay for the apartment each month and send her children to school. The apartment has a sewing machine and other tools similar to those Natalie Gumperts used in her work. She made the largest room into her workspace. That was where she saw people who wanted clothes made or repaired.
The next apartment we visit belonged to the Baldizzi family. They came from Italy and were Catholic. Adolfo Baldizzi, his wife Rosaria, and their two children moved to Orchard Street in 1928. Their daughter Josephine liked to help other people. Every Friday night, she would turn on the lights in the nearby apartment of the Rosenthal family. The Rosenthals could not turn on the lights themselves because it was the start of the Jewish holy day, and no work was permitted. Here is a recording of Josephine Baldizzi. She tells how she felt each week when she saw Mrs. Rosenthal in the window, motioning for her to come and turn on the lights.
It made me very proud to have to do that. I used to feel good that she chose me to do that job for her. And I can still see her till today. The vision of her in that window, it has never left my memory.
Now we visit the apartment of the Rogorshevsky family of Lithuania. They moved to 97 Orchard Street between 1907 and 1910. Abraham and Fanny Rogorshevsky had 6 children. Abraham developed the disease tuberculosis and died in 1918. Fanny Rogorshevsky was faced with the same problem as Natalie Gumperts. What could she do to support her family and continue to live in the apartment? She got the building owner to let her clean apartments and do other work in exchange for rent. Mrs. Rogorshevsky stayed in this building and cleaned its rooms even after the other renters were forced out in 1935. She moved out of 97 Orchard and into a nearby public housing project in 1941.
Now we enter the apartment of the Levine family. They were Jews from Poland. Jenny and Harris Levine moved into the building in the early 1890s. They lived there for more than 10 years. During that time, Mrs. Levine gave birth to 4 children. Her husband and his workers produced clothing in the front room. We see the room as it looked after the workers had gone home at the end of the day. We hear stories about the many immigrants who have worked in the clothing industry in New York.
Still another apartment is an example of living history. It belonged to the Confino family in 1916. Abraham and Rachel Confino came to New York from Turkey. They were Sephardic Jews, people whose ancestors had been born in Spain, North Africa, or Middle Eastern countries. An actress who plays 13-year-old Victoria Confino welcomes us. She tells about Victoria's experience living in the building. Here, she explains the language of Sephardic Jews, called Ladino, and sings part of a sad Ladino song.
Oh, it's a very mixed-up language. It's like a little bit Spanish. We call it Judeo-Espanol. And it's a little bit Turkish, a little bit Hebrew. A lot of language are mixed up altogether. Tu madre cuando te parió y quito al mundo corazón ella no te dio para amar segundo.
Writer Jane Ziegelman recently published a book that explores food culture from the point of view of five families who lived at 97 Orchard Street. Her book is called 97 Orchard, An Edible History of Five Immigrant Families in One New York Tenement. Jane Ziegelman explores the many food traditions that German, Irish, Italian, and other immigrants brought with them to the United States. And she shows how these food traditions have influenced American cooking. For example, Germans brought the tradition of pale beer to the United States. She also discusses a German restaurant in New York that served a meat dish known as hamburger steak. This meal would evolve into what is now considered a truly American food, the hamburger.
Ms. Ziegelman suggests that the Irish were less protective of their food traditions. This is because they came from a country filled with poverty and the effects of failing. She says Italians felt very strongly about the quality of their food. They were happy to pay more to have oils, dried vegetables, and tomato products imported from their homeland.
Jane Ziegelman says from the 19th century on, immigrants would take difficult jobs that non-immigrants would not do. These include working as food sellers, beer brewers, bakers, butchers, and restaurant servers. Her book helps show how important the hard work of immigrants was in feeding America.
This program was written by Nancy Steinbach and Dana Demange, who was also the producer. Our program was voiced by Bob Doty and Faith Lapidus. And I'm Steve Ember, inviting you to join us again next week for This is America from VOA Learning English. Thank you.